Good evening and welcome to this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. On today's Evening Report, remembering Ramon, Robert Amon, known as Ramon, who was a major player in the Earth First Cove Mallard campaign in central Idaho, died Saturday. We'll hear one of our interviews with Ramon and other interviews from the campout celebrating the 20-year anniversary of the Cove Mallard campaign in 2013. The campaign blocked logging roads in the central Idaho de facto wilderness and saved a major chunk of ecosystem at the end of the Forest Service's big logging project era during the 1990s. Also later in the program, we'll rerun our interview with shooting victim Sierra Valentine, who was shot at in her home early Tuesday morning by her neighbor. We'll also hear a report on the Moscow Saturday Farmers Market given at Tuesday night's city council meeting. But first, FSN World headlines and a roundup of regional news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Benji Hire. World leaders, including U.S. President Joe Biden, have arrived in New Delhi for this weekend's G20 summit, the first to be held in India. Mr. Biden also met with India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi for bilateral talks on Friday evening. On the scene, Rebecca Bunden has the latest.
The White House says it anticipates progress on a jet engines deal after General Electric announced it had signed an agreement with India's state-owned Hindustan Aeronautics to jointly make engines in India for Indian Air Force fighter jets. Civil nuclear technology is another area that Mr. Biden is looking to advance through the talks.
A lot's riding on the summit's success for India, but as Neha Punia reports, Russia and China's leaders skipping the event is raising questions about the group's ability to effectively address global challenges.
Ukraine will feature high on the agenda, which is why there is concern among some quarters here in India that the sort of geopolitical tensions and rifts we've seen between the US and China could in that sense derail that agenda. But India is quite clear that it is going to be focusing on bridging the divide, not between the West and the East, but between the developed and the developing world. Mr. Modi says that he's going to ensure that talks focus on climate change, on food security, on health.
Elsewhere, Ukraine's condemning what it calls sham elections held in Russia-occupied regions. Candidates are either all Russian or pro-Russian and include governors hand-picked by Moscow. Many taking part in early polling have been asked to cast their votes in the presence of armed Russian soldiers. Daria Bondarchuk has more.
Moscow has launched a three-day voting in what it calls Russia's new territories, the regions of Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk and Luhansk. The EU denounced the vote as a flagrant violation of international law. Kyiv claimed that balloting in the areas where Russia conducts active hostilities poses a threat to lives and urged other countries not to recognize the results of the vote.
Meanwhile, Elon Musk has disclosed that he refused to provide Ukraine access to his Starlink communications network over Crimea in order to avoid complicity in, quote, a major act of war. By refusing Kyiv's request, a senior Ukrainian official accused the billionaire of committing evil and defending war criminals. In North Korea, leader Kim Jong-un's revealed what Pyongyang claims is its first submarine capable of launching nuclear weapons. Dozens have been hospitalized in Hong Kong and in cities across southern China, submerged by flooding caused by the heaviest rains in over 140 years. Shares in Apple have fallen roughly $200 billion following reports that Chinese government workers have been banned from using iPhones. China is the tech giant's third largest market, accounting for 18% of its total revenue, and it's where most of Apple's products are manufactured. And a Turkish cryptocurrency boss, Faruk Faith Uzer, and his two siblings have been jailed for 11,196 years each for defrauding investors of millions of dollars. From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. As of late this afternoon, two more candidates have added their names to the list of now six candidates who are running for three open seats on the six-seat Moscow City Council up for election in November this year. The winners will serve four-year terms, and they will join council members Haley Lewis, Julia Parker, and Gina Taruccio, who have 2 years remaining in their terms. Mayor Art Bedke also has 2 years remaining in his term. The two new candidates announced since earlier this week are former City Council candidate and former Moscow Planning and Zoning Commission member Evan Holmes, and Drew Davis, who is also on the City Council. Mayor Bettke appointed Drew Davis as the sixth City Council member when Ann Zabala resigned in the middle of her term to move to Japan. The other four candidates are incumbent City Council member Sandra Kelly, recent University of Idaho political science graduate Nathan Tupper, WSU philosophy professor and former KRFP DJ Joe Campbell, and University of Idaho philosophy instructor Bryce Blankenship. The terms of council members Sandra Kelly, Maureen Laughlin, and Drew Davis are ending this year. Laughlin has so far not filed candidacy papers for re-election. The deadline for filing candidacy papers was 5 p.m. today. It's unclear if there will be any names added to the list that is currently available on the Latah County Elections webpage. There will also be contested races in all three Moscow school board zones. Incumbent Jim Frenzel, incumbent Dulcie Kirsting-Lark, and incumbent Don Fazio are all running for re-election. In Zone 1, Cody Barr is challenging Jim Frenzel. In Zone 3, Gay Lynn Clyde is challenging Dulcie Kirsting-Lark. And in Zone 4, former candidate for Moscow Mayor Jim Gray is challenging Don Fazio. The winners will serve four-year terms. Board of Trustees members Ken Fonts from Zone 2 and Brian Kennedy from Zone 5 have 2 years remaining in their terms. Ken Fonts is the school board chair and also chair of the City of Moscow Human Rights Commission. Bonner County Commissioners certified the results of the West Bonner School Board recall election yesterday, but not without some last-minute maneuvering by the recalled board members and the superintendent they voted to hire, Brandon Durst. The tally was 762 votes to recall School Board Chair Keith Rutledge, with 454 voting against, and 624 voting to recall Vice Chair Susan Brown, with 322 voting against. Voters in West Bonner School District Zones 2 and 4 voted last week to recall the two school board members, both of whom voted to hire Idaho Freedom Foundation analyst Brandon Durst as superintendent in May. Rutledge and Brown also campaigned against a $4.7 million supplemental levy, which voters rejected in May, which means the district budget is down 33%. Durst had no educational experience, and the original contract said the board could fire him if he did not obtain a waiver from the State Board of Education allowing him to serve as superintendent, despite not having the required 4 years of school experience, either as a teacher or administrator. The board scheduled a meeting on the eve of the county commissioner certifying the election results, despite a restraining order from a judge prohibiting the board from taking any action that would financially or contractually obligate the district until after the recall election was certified. That restraining order was issued Friday before another meeting that the Board of Trustees had scheduled, but then canceled for September 1st. The meeting Wednesday was canceled about an hour and a half before it was due to start. Priest River attorney Katie Elsesser told the board in an email Wednesday the agenda items were improper for a special meeting. On Friday of last week, Elsesser sought and was granted a restraining order from a judge against the school board for a meeting the board had scheduled for that evening. The Idaho Education News reports law enforcement shut down that meeting a half hour before it was scheduled to begin after the board received notice of the restraining order prohibiting it from taking action to contractually or financially obligate the district until after the results of the election take effect. The Friday meeting agenda also had items dissolving the school board and handing the meeting over to Superintendent Durst and amending Durst's contract so he could not be fired if he does not obtain superintendent certification from the State Board of Education. The certification is necessary because Durst does not have any of the required 4 years experience working as a school administrator or instructor, and the State Board of Education has not granted that waiver yet. Durst applied for the waiver, according to the spokesman review, last week. The Idaho Education News reports, despite the apparently canceled school board meeting last week, they have obtained a copy of an amended superintendent's contract that recalled board chair Rutledge signed Tuesday. The agenda for Wednesday night's meeting that was canceled included an executive session for superintendent evaluation and board clerk evaluation, and two items reaffirming board actions at previous meetings in June and August. Speaking of the agenda of Wednesday night's planned meeting, Elsa Sir, who had filed a 29-page lawsuit against the board, said these items not only are unnecessary but appear to only benefit Mr. Durst and Ms. Parody, which is a breach of your fiduciary duty as trustees if you proceed with the special meeting and items on the agenda. Board of Trustee member Margaret Hall, who is one of two of the more moderate board members who was not recalled, said she would not attend Wednesday night's meeting because it would be in violation of the judge's court order. Hall wrote in an email to the board it would be inappropriate to hold an employee evaluation after the second day of classes in the school year. She wrote, any reason for holding such evaluation appears to be for the sake of being able to check the box that an evaluation was done and a contract may be renewed. The spokesman review reported Rutledge signed an addendum to Durst's contract on August 22nd that contained changes that Hall said she was not made aware of at the time and that were not approved by the full board. Durst sent a tweet Monday encouraging the board to defy court orders. He wrote, unconstitutional court orders should be defied. A tyrannical judicial branch must not be tolerated. The Idaho Public Utilities Commission announced Tuesday they have approved gas and electricity rate increases for Avista customers in northern Idaho. There will be a 2.7% increase this month and a 0.01% increase next September. According to the spokesman review, the boosts will give Avista a base revenue for electric service of about 8% this month and 1.4% next September. In a Tuesday press release, the Idaho Public Utilities Commission said Avista needed the rate increase to recoup costs for, quote, fixed expenses and ongoing investments in infrastructure, technology, and more. The press release said the agreement allows Avista to operate sustainably. An Idaho 4th Judicial District Court ordered the state to pay Joseph LaCroix $319,000 to compensate for 6 years wrongful incarceration. According to the Idaho Capital Sun, Judge Peter Barton granted LaCroix his certificate of innocence Tuesday. A court in Bonneville County wrongfully convicted LaCroix October 3, 2017, for failing to register as a sex offender, which is a felony crime. On March 8th of this year, the 4th District Court vacated LaCroix's conviction, saying he was innocent, and they dismissed the case. At issue is an Oregon case when LaCroix was a juvenile and was charged with third-degree sodomy. 7th Judicial District Judge Michael White wrote in a March 24th order that LaCroix should have never been required to register as a sex offender in Idaho because LaCroix was a juvenile at the time of the Oregon offense, and because LaCroix was charged and adjudicated as a juvenile, he was never convicted of a crime. Barton wrote, pursuant to Idaho Code, LaCroix is entitled to be paid $319,297 under the Wrongful Conviction Act. The court awarded LaCroix $3,298 in attorney's fees as well. Plus, the Department of Correction will determine within its discretion the types of reentry services LaCroix is entitled to, including up to 30 days of transitional housing. Oregon law says juveniles can petition to simply admit or deny allegations and that they are not convicted. White wrote, neither an admission of the juvenile nor finding by court that the facts alleged in the petition are true is conviction. Because LaCroix was never convicted of crime in Oregon, he does not meet Idaho's statutory requirements that would necessitate him to register on Idaho's sex offender registry. According to the Wrongful Conviction Act, LaCroix is entitled to $62,000 for every year he was incarcerated. The act also allows LaCroix to be compensated $25,000 for each year he was on parole. The Idaho Board of Examiners Subcommittee is scheduled to meet next Tuesday to finalize the payments to LaCroix. Republican Idaho Senate leaders announced Wednesday they have gathered signatures from 60% of senators to call the legislature into special session to address the March presidential primary election issue. The petition must now receive 60% support from House lawmakers for the special session to take place. By a slim majority, Idaho voters passed Senate Joint Resolution 102 in last year's November elections, which gives the legislature the power to call itself back into session with a written petition signed by 60% of the members of each chamber of the legislature. Before that, only the governor could call the legislature into special session. The legislature eliminated the March presidential primary during this year's legislative session when they passed House Bill 138, which Governor Brad Little signed. The bill was intended to save the state up to $2.7 million every 4 years by moving the presidential primary from March to May, which is the election date for the state's other primaries. However, House Bill 138 eliminated the presidential primary without moving it to the third week in May. Lawmakers then introduced a trailer bill, House Bill 1186, to fix the problem, which was designed to move the presidential primary election to May. House Bill 1186 died in the House State Affairs Committee after Idaho Republican Party Chair Dorothy Moon of Stanley opposed it. The legislature then adjourned for the year. The Idaho Republican Party Central Committee voted in June to create a presidential nominating caucus, which would be held the first Saturday in March unless the legislature was to reconvene in a special session before October 1st to restore the March primary election. Some Republican lawmakers say they worry a caucus will divide the party and lead to lower voter turnout because of requirements to attend in person at a set date and time for several hours. Last month, Republican Senator Scott Herndon of Sagal and Senate President Pro Tem Chuck Winder of Boise began circulating separate petitions to call the legislature into special session to address and possibly reinstate the March presidential primary or move it to May. The Idaho Capital Sun reports Republican House Speaker Mike Moyle of Star said on Wednesday, members of the House are divided over the issue and are forming factions, with some preferring a March primary and others preferring a May primary, and some preferring to take no action since the Idaho Republican Party already voted to hold a caucus if the March presidential primary is not reinstated. Moyle said in a telephone interview, so far we haven't been able to hit the sweet spot where we get 42 signatures necessary to go back into session. If 60% of House members do sign the petition, a special session would start no later than 15 days after Moyle and Winder receive the petitions. If one of the petitions is not signed by 60% of House members or Senate members, there will be no special session. Washington Lands Commissioner Hillary France announced the state will install 21 artificial intelligence fire detection cameras in various fire danger zones, which will lower wildfire response times. According to the spokesman review at a news conference at the Department of Natural Resources headquarters in Ellensburg yesterday, France said alerting dispatch centers at the first signs of a fire can make a big difference in determining whether a fire ends up being a small brush fire or something much bigger. France spoke about the Gray and Oregon Road fires in Spokane County last month, which destroyed hundreds of houses and other structures and killed two people. France said more than 1,000 firefighters from several jurisdictions responded. She said, at any point in time in any community, whether it's rural, suburban, or urban, we are all at risk in Washington State, central, eastern, and western Washington. It's also a reminder that we are still in the midst of fire season. Lands Commission spokesperson Michael Kelly said the Department of Natural Resources has teamed up with Pano AI, a California-based wildfire detection company, and T-Mobile cell phone company to install 21 fire detection cameras around the state by next June. Kelly said crews have already set 9 of the 21 fire detection cameras on poles. He said crews set up those cameras on existing infrastructure, mainly cell phone towers. Lands officials say since April, there have been more than 1,700 fires, which have burned 155,000 acres in the state. Franz said, we know that we still have a few more months to go. We got a little bit of rain, but it's hot and dry again. Department of Natural Resources Wildfire Division Assistant Manager Angie Lane said, Pano AI and fire officials are placing the cameras where they will be most useful. Each site will have two 360-degree AI cameras, Lane said. They are in high-priority areas where we've experienced a large number of fires. That, combined with the topography and the fuels that are located at these sites, makes them prime locations for each detection system. When a camera detects a fire, it sends an alert to Natural Resource Department dispatch centers, which will treat the alert as if it were a 911 call. A fire official will then view the footage to verify if the fire is authentic. The camera will help firefighters get the proper coordinates so firefighters can find the fire, especially when a fire is in a remote location or in difficult terrain. France said AI cameras can reduce response times, which improves safety for firefighters and civilians. France said the goal is to eventually install 60 cameras around the state. She said, this isn't a small state. 22 Pano cameras don't get you very far, and having them just on state lands also doesn't necessarily help you, because we have to be bringing in our partners, our federal lands, our private lands, and our tribal lands. In a meeting yesterday, University of Idaho officials decided to indefinitely delay the destruction of the King Road home where University of Idaho students Kaylee Gonsalves, Madison Mogan, Zaina Kernodal, and Ethan Chapin were stabbed to death last November. Law enforcement arrested 28-year-old former Washington State University graduate student Brian Koberger for the murders December 30th in Pennsylvania. The Latah County Sheriff's Department is holding Koberger in the county jail on 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of felony burglary. Judge John Judge postponed Koberger's trial last month to an unspecified date after Koberger waived his right to a speedy trial last month. Koberger faces the death penalty if convicted. 3 of the murder victims were renting the home with 2 other roommates. The 2 other roommates were at home but were not harmed in the attack, which an affidavit says occurred at about 4 a.m. November 13th. After Moscow police completed their investigation at the home in February, the property's owner donated the property to the UI. The university initially announced it would demolish the home in August before the start of the fall semester, but there was pushback from the victims' families, with 3 of the families questioning why the university would destroy the home before the trial. The UI relented and agreed to wait until October to demolish the 6-bedroom property. At the time the UI relented, the judge had scheduled the trial for October 2nd. Koberger waived his right to a speedy trial late last month, which again raised questions about demolishing the home. Although the court and both the prosecution and defense had no issues with the UI demolishing the house. Judge Judge has delayed the trial to an undetermined date in the future. Gonsalves family attorney Shannon Gray told the Idaho Statesman, "I think all of the families assumed that the King Road address would not be demolished until the trial's over." At yesterday's meeting, UI officials again agreed to delay the destruction of the home, this time indefinitely, but were noncommittal about delaying the destruction of the home until after Koberger's trial. UI spokesperson Jody Walker told the Idaho Statesman in a phone interview yesterday, "I think anything's possible. We certainly want to do what is in the best interest of our students, the university, and keeping in mind the families as well. It's a huge decision and a huge moment in their lives." The UI said yesterday they would hold off on demolishing the home until at least mid-December after the semester ends, but have not set a new demolition date. Walker said the King Road house will not come down this semester. "We will be moving forward, continuing to prepare for the actual end." Walker said the university was trying to balance what's right for students, continues to focus on their education, and do right by the memories of the students that were lost. Walker said the university will provide 2 weeks advance notice of any destruction plans once they are scheduled. She said the property has been cleared of all victims' belongings, and it is only expected to take a matter of hours to demolish the home and dispose of its materials. Besides the emotional cost of continuing to oversee the property, the UI faces a financial one. The UI initially hired a third-party security company to watch the property and this week transitioned to its own university security officers, which Walker said is costing around $600 a day. That has cost the university approximately $131,000 since they took ownership of the home. Walker said there are currently no plans for the site once the home is destroyed. However, the UI continues to work on developing a memorial garden to honor the King Road victims and other UI students who have died in past years. The UI has not announced a location for the memorial garden. Walker said the school is fundraising for the student-driven project, but the estimated cost and timeline for completion are unknown until the university approves a plan for the memorial. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by the Moscow Food Co-op, specializing in food, goods, and programs that nourish and nurture our community. The Moscow Food Co-op is located at 121 East 5th Street. For more information, visit moscowfood.coop, call 882-8537, or find them on Facebook.
Pullman police say one of the victims in a stabbing attack on College Hill Wednesday told them the woman who did the stabbing said she thought the other victim was, quote, the devil. Police arrested 29-year-old Tiffany Dennison of California Wednesday for allegedly stabbing a couple on Pullman's College Hill. The Daily News reports police responded to a report of a stabbing around 9 a.m. Wednesday in the 1300 block of Northeast Williams Drive. The probable cause affidavit said one of the victims, Samantha Branch, told Whitman County dispatchers her boyfriend, Hunter Degler, had been stabbed in the back by a woman. Police officer Alex Gordon wrote, when police arrived on the scene, he and another officer saw Degler with a significant amount of blood on the back of his white tank top and saw Dennison standing and holding an 8 to 12 inch chef-style knife. The officer said Dennison was making slicing and poking motions at Degler and Branch. Branch was holding Dennison's arms from behind to prevent her from stabbing Degler again. The affidavit said Officer Gordon then drew his taser and used it on Dennison, who dropped the knife to the ground. Gordon and the other officer then handcuffed and arrested Dennison. Degler is the primary caregiver of a child that lives at the residence. branch told police she had tried to defend Degler after Denison's initial attack using a baby gate as a shield. The affidavit says Denison told him that she had stabbed him because she could not let the child be raised by the devil. Ambulance crews transported Degler to Pullman Regional Hospital. Degler suffered a punctured lung in the attack, but the knife missed major arteries in his back. Responders also took Branch to the hospital and treated her for non-life-threatening injuries to her hands. Denison was taken to the Whitman County Jail on charges of attempted second-degree murder, second-degree assault, and having weapons capable of producing bodily harm. Denison has no prior criminal history.
The wait to curb emissions from Seattle buildings has gone on long enough, climate groups say. The Seattle City Council is considering building emissions performance standards, which would require the city's biggest buildings to cut their climate pollution completely by 2045. Apartments would have a 2050 deadline. Jess Wallach with 350 Seattle says buildings are the second largest source of carbon emissions in the city, but this policy has been delayed and watered down over the past 2 years.
This is an opportunity to ensure that the biggest buildings in Seattle, which are by and large owned by wealthy corporations and real estate giants, are on track for a just transition to move their buildings off of fossil fuels and onto Seattle's clean energy grid.
350 Seattle recently released a report that found almost none of the largest buildings in Seattle are owned by individuals or families, and that about half are owned by private entities based outside the city. Building owners say the plan is too costly. Wallach says the city council was going to vote on the standards in September, but has delayed it, likely until the beginning of next year. Deepa Sivarajan is the Washington local policy manager for climate solutions. She says Seattle is facing increased threats from climate change, including hotter summers, and notes that transitioning away from fossil fuel use will help the city build climate resiliency and lower utility costs.
So many of our buildings are not air conditioned in Seattle, and electric heat pumps, which are the most cost-effective and energy-efficient solution when you're switching over from a fossil fuel to electricity, they provide heating and cooling together.
Washington State has passed its own energy efficiency standard for buildings. But Wallach says rather than duplicating those rules, Seattle's standards would increase their effectiveness.
Seattle's policy is going to help ensure that the state-level policy is not only implemented here, but actually goes further and faster and more successfully, and in that way we can be a model for other cities around Washington.
The building emissions performance standards would reduce Seattle building emissions 27% by 2050, according to the city. This is Eric Tegeda for Washington News Service.
KRFP thanks its listeners and supporters, including the Palouse Folklore Society, celebrating traditional music and dance on the Palouse since 1982. The Palouse Folklore Society sponsors concerts, jam sessions, and a monthly contra dance. Find out more at palousefolk.org or on Facebook.
And you're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report. We now turn to our first featured segment. Robert Amon, better known as Ramon, has died at the age of 86. We'll have an interview with Ramon in a bit. Ramon was a major figure in the Earth First campaign to save the Cove Mallard roadless area in central Idaho from a multiple clear-cut logging project in the 1990s. He purchased a Forest Service in-holding south of Dixie, which Earth First activists used as a base camp for logging road blockades and tree sits to slow logging until judges recognized violations of environmental laws on the part of Forest Service timber sale planners. Ramon reportedly died Saturday. The activists were also successful in stopping most of the logging in the nearby biodiverse Otter Wing timber sales southeast of Grangeville until the Clinton administration's roadless rule kicked in. The Otter Wing included a rare coastal disjunct ecosystem. One of Ramon's friends, Don Kimball, wrote on Facebook, "Longtime friend, mentor, and forest activist Robert Ramon Amon has died at age 86. A tireless champion for the forests, we'll miss his tanned, toothy smile and tall tales about the trees he helped to save from the saw. This Equitable Insurance executive turned enviro inspired many to heed the call to save the last of America's ancient forests and not only talked the talk but walked the walk, buying an old school bus with Billy Packer, a reformed commercial fisher. They formed the Ancient Forest Bus Brigade from a collection of castaways, including Catfish, an ex-con, Cindy, a recovering heroin addict, Russell, the runaway, and Bones, the old hound dog. Together, they traveled the West supporting forest activists in California, Oregon, and Idaho, eyed with suspicion by locals for his ability to speak and write about the true costs of the boom and bust cycles in communities whose economies depended on the mills. He was often threatened and vilified by them. Indeed, when he was once called a cult leader by an Idaho newspaper, Earth First hero the late Judy Berry nicknamed him the Brunch Ramonian Leader, in a tongue-in-cheek comparison to David Koresh and his Branch Davidian followers in Waco, Texas, who were burned out by jackbooted thugs of the FBI and ATF in 1993. That same year, the Cove Mallard Coalition in Dixie, Idaho, which was camped on Ramon's land, trying to save the last largest roadless area in the lower 48, was raided by federal marshals with automatic weapons. Fortunately, there was no violence that day. For more than a decade, Ramon and the Ancient Forest Bus Brigade roamed the West supporting actions against the extractive industries. Once, when the Havasupai Nation's water supply was threatened with a uranium mine proposal, Ramon took members of the tribe, some who had never ventured out of the Supai Canyon, to Las Vegas for a Department of Energy hearing on the mine. As the tribal members gazed in amazement at the strange sights of Glitter Gulch, Ramon asked the last elder off the bus if they were missing anything. The tribal elder replied, "Yes, missing Supai." "We'll all miss Ramon, R.I.P. pal." That was from a Facebook post by one of Ramon's friends, Don Kimball. Ramon was present at the 20-year Cove Mallard campaign reunion at a remote campsite along the Salmon River in the summer of 2013. This interview is from that reunion campout.
The journalists, like in the Lewiston paper, mainstream press, and the federal police or the Forest Service police, they always seem to have to want to have a leader. And for the first year, at least, it was like Ramon was the leader. Then they decided somebody else was later, right? So I was wondering what your recollection of that and how it felt to be tagged as a leader in this sort of amorphous movement that really doesn't have leaders.
It didn't feel good because my colleagues immediately disowned me,
right?
on the one hand, and the media made out of me what I wasn't, so that didn't feel good. But it was funny. At least it was humorous.
People didn't follow the man. They followed the shirt.
Wait, well, yeah.
This shirt.
One much like it.
But you were the guy that they went to for, you know, funny quotes, it seemed like. That's why they liked you, and that's why you got pegged as leader, right? Plus you're on the land.
Napoleon had funny quotes. That's why maybe you think he was the leader? They asked him whose side God was on in any battle. He said, the side with the best artillery. It's all about ink.
Right. But, yeah, so you never sat in a tripod. I mean, you didn't necessarily do the physical labor setting up the blockades or anything like that.
Physical
right?
labor?
Yeah.
Moi?
Do you have enough energy to get up a tripod?
I have barely enough energy to get up in the morning.
And yet you seem quite energetic and perky 20 years later.
Because I'm only 24.
Ah, right.
Centigrade.
Yeah.
Do the math.
75.
Close enough.
Okay. Yeah. So I got to ask, what have you been doing since then? Do you live in Guatemala? Is that the case?
I live in my sandals.
Wow.
Wherever they are, I am. And that's been everywhere in Latin America, Australia. I walked across England 2 years ago.
Wow.
I'm going to go live in Barbados in the Caribbean this winter.
Mm-hmm.
And I never plan more than 6 months ahead, so don't ask me what I'm going to be doing next year.
Yeah, but in the since Cove Mallard, have you been involved in any other like environmental campaigns of this sort?
No. We won Cove Mallard and I retired, and that's it. I'm not coming out of retirement unless the bastards decide to go back into Cove Mallard, in which case you'll see my ugly mug around here again.
Right. I see. And in even Otter Wing, you weren't involved in that, or whatever. Okay.
I'm a one deal bozo.
And so what do you think of this reunion after all these years? Was there another reunion 10 years ago or something? Or?
I don't remember there being one.
Okay.
I was out of the country. It may have been. I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Well, what do you think of this one?
Well, I think that the 40th is going to be better.
Oh, wow. When you're 95. I mean,
32 Celsius.
Right, okay.
And that was an interview with Robert Amon, also known as Ramon, who died last week at the age of 86, a active member of the Cove Mallard campaign in central Idaho in the 90s, and part of Earth First. We have another interview from the 20-year Cove Mallard campaign reunion in 2013. This one is with Jake Krylik, who was heavily involved in the campaign to block logging roads to save one of the largest remaining intact ecosystems and roadless areas in the lower 48. Although he doesn't talk about Ramon, the interview gives perspective about the impact of the Cove Mallard campaign at the close of the era of giant Forest Service timber sales in the 1990s. Here's that interview.
With you, I could probably ask some of those questions about the impact of the campaign, not just on this, but on other campaigns, because there was a lot of stuff going on in the 90s having to do with timber sales all over, and the Cove Mallard campaign was key because of the ecological specialness of the place and so forth. But what can you tell me about the Cove Mallard campaign's impact on other campaigns in the 90s and maybe leading up to the roadless rule?
Sure. It was the definitive campaign in terms of roadless area protection and roadless area defense. It was a campaign that obviously did focus on very large area within the Frank Church, around the edge of the Frank Church River No Return Wilderness, which is our largest wilderness, designated wilderness in the lower 48 states. It was also close to two other important wilderness areas, the Gospel Hump and the Selway Bitterroot. So its uniqueness was really shaped by the size of the country, the amount of unprotected roadless lands in the area, and of course, central Idaho still has the most remaining unprotected roadless lands in the lower 48 states. So Cove Mallard, again, was a defining campaign in sort of putting roadless areas on the map. It did lead to, eventually, the Roadless Area Conservation Rule, which you alluded to, that former Chief Mike Dombach rolled out in the late 90s. And, of course, it didn't become official until right before Clinton left office, and has been mired in a series of protracted legal battles. But it does look like it's going to survive. And so, you know, the Roadless Area Conservation Rule, I don't think it would have happened if we didn't have campaigns like Cove Mallard, you know, that were really shining the light on what the agency was still doing with its timber sale program, with its road building program, you know, again, with its very heavy-handed footprint, you know, on the national forest system. So Cove Mallard was a really, really important campaign. Certainly it did help, I think, that we had other campaigns on the West Coast protecting ancient forests, which was another big, you know, focal point. But in terms of, I think, really a campaign that galvanized a lot of support for protecting not so much big trees, but big landscapes.
And the Cove Mallard timber sales themselves, you know, how bad were they? I mean, I understand they're in between two de facto wilderness areas, so it's a wildlife corridor, and they were huge. But, you know, how many did you stop?
Well, it was the end of an era, you know, in terms of the reason they rolled this out was because the timber sale program had sort of reached its zenith. And so this, in the terms of at least the inner mountain, you know, sort of northern Rockies region, it's the largest timber sale we'd ever seen. A total of 9 separate timber sales that were lumped into one. It called for the construction of 145 miles of new road in these 9 sales and cutting 81 million board feet of timber. In the end, they were able to log 3 sales, Grouse, Noble, and Jack. Jack was the last one, and that was the site of the big road siege and road blockade in 96. But in the end, they got 3 out of the 9. I'd say they got about maybe a quarter of the timber they wanted, and maybe about a fifth of the roads that they wanted to build. So we were really successful in stopping the worst of it. Some of these sales, as we drove down here to the site today or earlier in the week, was through the BAT timber sale. That was all protected. They didn't get there. Lone Park, which was the furthest out to the east, didn't get that. Blowout, didn't get that. Rhett, didn't get that. So again, some really important drainages and wild areas were protected. The areas that they did get, you know, Grouse was right off the road, off of 222, so it wasn't that significant. You know, I think Jack and Noble were both pretty serious incursions, you know, into really nice roadless country. But again, those were the sites of the most direct action, mm-hmm. most arrests. You know, so they were really the controversial areas that did get the majority of the attention throughout the 6 years of the campaign.
Yeah, and so the genetic corridor is largely intact, but they did get all the timber sales they wanted in Otter Wing, which came later in the 90s.
Otter Wing came later, and they did complete those sales. Those are smaller roadless areas on the edge of the Gospel Hump. So again, important areas, but not as deep, you know, not as deep into the, you know, to the wilderness.
So federal law enforcement was on your case even before you started blockading anything, from what I remember. And tell us about some of the encounters with law enforcement and how they tried to stop the campaign, and what you know, maybe there's a good couple good stories here.
Oh, well, I mean, obviously we got to know Forest Service law enforcement officers firsthand. There was a number of raids on our land when we, after we purchased the 20 acres up on the Comstock mine. And in fact, there still is a lot of gear that's, you know, sort of in custody, you know, in Forest Service custody. We keep trying to get it back. But that was, again, a function of the protests that we were doing, the direct action. And so they came down with some pretty heavy-handed tactics. They, you know, they did do sort of the, you know, an illegal search and seizure, you know, at the property. You know, activists were subject to, you know, getting pulled over, you know, on many occasions just driving around, whether they were doing recon or, you know, whether they were just going to and fro for supplies. And so, yeah, I mean, it was a very kind of hostile environment. We didn't obviously have any local support to speak of in the area, at least no one that was outspoken about it. And then, of course, the combination of the Idaho County Law Sheriff's Office and then the Forest Service LEOs. You know, it was not an easy place to operate in. And despite that, we were able to pull off, you know, a lot of actions and a lot of things that sort of gummed up the works, made it slower. So there were a lot of delays and a lot of things that really sort of got under their skin, and it turned into a war of attrition. A lot of activists, such as myself, were eventually sued by the road builder, Highland Enterprises, mm-hmm. and so I was forced to file bankruptcy. They came after me in Missoula, and eventually I did settle for $15,005. What I owed was $100,000. They didn't come after everyone, but they came after people who they thought they could get something out of. But in the end, the money they got from me and from Eric Ryberg was a pittance compared to what they had to spend. You know, what they spent in terms of fighting us and filing the slap suit, you know, the civil suit, and really coming after activists. It cost them a lot of time and money. So, you know, in the end, when you look back on it, there was a human cost.
Well, it's called a slap suit because it's a strategic lawsuit against political participation, right?
Public participation, yeah.
Right. So basically what they're trying to do is slow you guys down.
Right, and of course they were using some Idaho state law that goes way, way back in terms of some of the commerce clauses that said, in effect, the road building company owned that road, and so we were stealing the road from them, even though obviously it's through public land. And so it got into some fairly complicated, economic legalese. But in the end, as I said, we certainly, number of activists were harassed, number of activists were sued, number of activists spent, plenty of time behind bars. But in the end, it was all worth it. It was all for the right reasons, for the right cause. And again, it not only changed the Nez Perce National Forest, and again, their approach, but again, it did have a national impact too.
Did you lock down yourself?
Yeah, I was part of the big action up on the Noble Road in the summer of 93, and I believe like over 20 of us got arrested in that action, and we were buried in the road. We had a series of tripods and bipods set up, shut them down for basically a full day, and then spent 3 weeks in jail, basically for the rest of July of 93. I was arrested a second time after, sort of being support for the action that Rick Valois did when he locked himself up on the Noble Road.
And that was quite the piece of video, is it not? He had his neck locked to the gate, and they kept swinging the gate open for the logging or the road building equipment.
Yeah, it was a full-on action, and that was Rick's redneck.
Yeah, okay.
Was the video. And, it's to that Jane's Addiction song, Coming Down the Mountain. And it was really well. I mean, it was a very dramatic action. But after the fact, so this was like in the winter, I get a summons. And basically, it accused me of violating the federal closure. I went to court in June of 96 before the Earth First Round River Rendezvous that was held in Cove Mallard. And after the rendezvous, I was sentenced to 3 months in jail. I was in Latah County for about 3 weeks before they moved me to a federal prison in Sheridan, Oregon. So it was kind of like really trying to, kind of pull my chain. They were really going after me.
They're moving you around a lot.
Yeah, psychologically, they were really trying to disrupt it. But the ironic part is our federal public defender in Washington, in Spokane, Gerald Smith, eventually succeeded in getting the closure ruled illegal. And so after 5 days in Sheridan, Oregon, all of a sudden I was kicked out with a bus ticket back to Moscow. And so I ended up doing like 30 days for that second arrest. So, yeah, I mean, I had a lot of things happen to me. But, in the end, the examples that they tried to make, no one backed down. No one ran away from the campaign. We didn't have, we had issues, of course, because it was a large campaign and we had a lot of different people show up over the course of the 6 years. But again, the solidarity was always there. We had a decent level of organization between the base camp, Missoula, Moscow, Boise. We had a reasonable level of organization. And all that paid off over time because in the end, we sort of outlasted the Forest Service, which is hard to do.
What's a Super Freddy? Can you tell me anything about that? Did that come in 93, a little bit later?
Yeah, these were these stealth Freddies that were sneaking around the woods with cameras and high-powered rifles. And it was
ex-Marines.
Ex-Marines. And, again, it was sort of like the Freddy SWAT force. How effective they were, they certainly were snooping on us and trying to collect information. But, none of that really mattered because we were a public campaign. This was all above board. And, the sneaking around in the woods and whatnot, certainly that stuff went on our side, to try and get back into the road systems and whatnot. But our actions, they speak for themselves. We accepted the consequences of those actions. And in the end, the monkey wrenching incidents and some of the, incidents of property destruction, they really did not, they didn't really harm the campaign, because we were public, and we were out front with what we were doing.
Do you have the story about the woman who went to take a squat out in the woods and ended up being 10 feet away from the camouflage?
Super Freddies. Chased him back up the woods, and then they eventually kind of converged on her because he was not operating alone.
Right. And he wasn't happy about being chased.
No, of course not, and But yet that was our private land. And so, again, it did become sort of a private property rights issue.
Oh, really? It
was it was right near our land, so they certainly weren't allowed on our land.
Right.
But such was the nature. You know, again, they were obviously trying to gain the upper hand in terms of intelligence and, you know, anticipating what our next move was. But, you know, really, that didn't matter over time because I think that ultimately the reason that we prevailed is we didn't go away, you know, and we kept, exposing what the agency was doing. And they couldn't justify, you know, that kind of project, the scale of it, you know, and again, the place, you know, and obviously anybody who came here was immediately drawn into the place because of how hard it was, you know, how inaccessible it was to get to.
So it's been 20 years. Have you been active in environmental issues since then? What have you been doing?
Well, the last 5 years or so, I still work for the Wild West Institute, which was a merger between the Native Forest Network and the Ecology Center in Missoula. But Wild West, we're involved, still in the fight to protect and restore, you know, our national forests in the Northern Rockies. I mostly work on two collaborative organizations, the Lola Restoration Committee, which works on restoring ranger districts in the Lolo National Forest, and then I'm also on the Lemhi County Forest Restoration Group in Salmon, Idaho. So most of my time now is spent more working in collaboration, designing projects that make sense, both in terms of ecological restoration, but also, you know, good jobs for the locals. So there is a socioeconomic component that makes sense. And then, of course, you know, a lot of community-based fuel reduction, you know, making sure people have defensible space around their homes and around their communities, so that we don't have to be out here thinning millions of acres of public land, which, you know, obviously doesn't make a lot of fiscal sense, but from an ecological sense, you know, that's what the fires do anyways.
Right.
You know, they're the cleansing agent.
Yeah, yeah. And they're being an excuse for these salvage sales nowadays.
Yeah, a lot of salvage that still goes on, of course. That's one way they can...
Some of it ecologically makes sense, and a lot of it doesn't.
A lot of it doesn't. Yeah. No, I mean, a lot of it doesn't.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's all I want.
Good.
Yeah.
That was Earth First campaigner Jake Krylik, interviewed in 2013 at the 20-year anniversary of the Cove Mallard campaign. We'll be back in a moment with more interviews from the 20th anniversary of the Cove Mallard campaign, as well as some recent remembrances of Ramon, and we'll hear one of his last letters. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, and you're listening to the KRFP Evening Report.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by Hotchins Drug and Hobby of 307 South Main Street in Moscow. Hotchins features a pharmacy, educational toys, and hobbies. Hotchins also sells and services hearing aids. You can call Hotchins at 208-882-5536.
They're coming. They're all around you. Menacing. Wreaking havoc.
Keeping the aisles in your store too cluttered for a wheelchair?
Don't be a zombie. If the aisles in your business are too narrow for wheelchairs, you're turning away customers. People with strollers can't even get through.
Don't be a zombie. For more information on the best ways to interact with people with disabilities, visit dacnw.org.
We now have an interview with one of Earth First's founders, Mike Rozelle, recorded at the Cove Mallard Campaign 20th Anniversary Campout in 2013.
It is Mike Rozelle, one of the founders of Earth First. So I think, I guess the first question is, how involved with the Cove Mallard Campaign? Because you seem to be the type of person who's like an Uber campaign. You go to different campaigns all the time, right? So how much were you here?
When I get into a campaign, I like to be in for the duration.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't commit to that many campaigns. I do work different levels on other campaigns, but this one was, took 7 years at least of my life. And, it was just one of the more important ones I think I ever worked on.
Okay. Yeah, I might have gotten an odd impression that maybe you weren't around because I didn't see you in Moscow that much, and you weren't on the land when the time, few times I came down. So
yeah, I actually wasn't here for a lot of the more important events. I was raising money, and we did some administrative work out of Moscow for a while, and then we moved our operation to Missoula and worked out of Missoula. So I would come out to the land frequently, but I didn't stay here, you know, really long periods of time like a lot of the people here did. And it was over a period of years, and there were times when I actually was living in San Francisco and raising money for the campaign. So it was at that point I was still doing quite a bit of traveling, and I was helping out with some other forest campaigns. But really, this was one of the few actual forest campaigns going, so there wasn't really a lot of other places where we needed to be.
Well, it was key ecologically and key influentially on other campaigns.
Well, you know, it come at a time when the success of our numerous lawsuits had meant really that we hadn't needed to do a lot of direct action. And so when this timber sale came up, we really had to, it took us a while to get anything at all going. You know, if it hadn't been for the bus brigade, you know, establishing camp out here, it was so far from Missoula, you know, it was far from Moscow. So that just gave us the ability to plant the flag and build the campaign around that. Otherwise, it would have been really, really difficult. Hey! We'll see you in Spokane, absolutely.
Yeah, give me a call.
Sorry about that.
That's all right. That's all right. So, you got any interesting stories about interactions with, I guess, the federal law enforcement or lockdowns, things like that? I'm sort of looking for interesting stories because that seems to be what's popping up.
Yeah, I one of the more, at least from my experiences, I missed a lot of the really interesting stories. But they had passed a law, the Idaho legislature. It was signed by the governor at the time, Cecil Andrus. Mm-hmm. Making it a felony to impede, obstruct, or anyway blockade a timber sale, and that even advocating to do it would be illegal, and they called it the Earth First Law. Mm-hmm. So that had been in effect for a while, but the injunction against any logging in this area was still in effect, so it didn't really seem to matter. There wasn't anybody worried too much about the law, but when the injunction was dropped, we had an encampment up here in the winter. We've had people living in snow caves. It was quite primitive. And we blocked the first trucks coming in to work on the road. And they arrested me and Tom Fulham for the felony. You know, before that, we had just got trespass and disturbing the peace and right. That type of thing. So now we had these felony charges. We were on the front pages of all the newspapers and all the TV stations. It really brought the campaign back to life. But we still had just a really small group at that point. So we took it to court, and we got the judge to throw it out. You know, mostly because we had built up a relationship with these loggers out here. They knew us. And when the truck driver got on the stand, you know, he just wouldn't back up the prosecutor's story that we were threatening and dangerous and disruptive. And, you know, he was kind of, oh, yeah, we see protesters all the time. You know, yeah, usually we stop when they're blocking stuff, and then we go when they not blocking stuff. He didn't sound very bothered.
Yeah. So the law itself didn't get tested, particularly the free speech part of it.
No, because they dismissed it, and then right after that they had the long blockade on the Jack Road, I guess, and they dug trenches, which was a big escalation for us here. You know, we were no property damage. This was a brand-new group that had come in because of a Earth First Rendezvous and a ruckus training camp that we had done. So we had some reinforcements, but they were ready to kick it up a notch. And even though they used all these tripods and dug ditches in the road and were up there for months, they never got charged with the Earth First Law. So the fact that we violated it, you know, the way we did, mm-hmm. It just made them... But there was no reason they couldn't have used it. I don't know why they didn't. But in Oregon, they passed a similar law after that. I broke that also. And we challenged that one all the way up to the Supreme Court, and actually it took a few years, but we got it struck down. So here we hadn't had to get it struck down because they just don't use it. It's so ridiculous.
Yeah. Now, in 93, there was a edition of the Lewiston Tribune that had a full-color picture of a ceramic spike that somehow they had found in the middle of this the timber sale area, obviously without metal detectors since it's ceramic, and supposedly nobody had sent a letter, as has been past practice when environmentalists spike trees. So what's your take on that? Was that some sort of like dirty trick to turn public opinion against the activists?
It would be hard to say. I don't know of any specific cases where they have done property destruction and blamed us. There's been a lot of cases where property destruction has been done by someone that unknown to us, and that we would be associated with that. There was some a little bit of that going on when we first got here, but I think people very clearly realized that it wasn't something we could do and maintain a base out here at the same time.
Right.
But I suspect, you know, we had people come up here who got very attached to the area, worked with the group for maybe a little while, but then, you know, maybe decided that they wanted to do something on their own or with a few of their trusted friends. So it could be possible something like that happened.
But it seems so strange that they would find this. And from what I remember of the article, it said they, whoever did it, glued the bark back on the tree over this ceramic spike.
Well, I mean, keep in mind, Earth First was still publishing articles on how to do these sorts of things. So, you know, you have to cast a pretty wide net, you know, a lot of possible suspects and something like that. But we certainly didn't know anyone doing it. We wouldn't have approved of it. Even if, you know, they wanted to disassociate themselves from us, we still wouldn't have approved of it. But there wouldn't have been anything we could have done about it.
Right. And, of course, the day it hit the front page was also the day Steve Paulson got beat up by the rednecks.
Yeah. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that we don't do the monkey wrench. And, you know, it sounds like, oh, well, that's the radical thing to do. But the repercussions that happen and the amount of secrecy you have to have, and it's very difficult to recruit new people, and you have attrition of the old people. It's just... you cannot sustain a campaign if there is monkey wrenching going on the perimeter.
Okay, so tell me what you've been doing since you've left Idaho. You've been very active in the West Virginia Mountain Top Removal campaign, right?
Yeah, well, basically, took a page out of the old Cove Mallard playbook, which was, you know, the same kind of campaigns that we had done in Oregon and California. It's based around the peace camp kind of concept, that you have a camp where people can come and become experienced with the area, the people, the issues, and, you know, and be trained in nonviolence. And we set up a kitchen, and we ran it for about 2.5 years. About, you know, 150 people were arrested. We wound up the campaign because it became too difficult to trespass on these. This is private land here, not public land like we have out here. And it just, with the lawsuits and the criminal charges, and it became very hard to sustain the campaign. So,
but there's other people carrying on some sort of campaign.
Right now there's another group doing direct action, and they're also, they have a something of a camp. So it's still continuing, and I think they had 20 people arrested in a action that shut down that part of the mine for, I'm sure, most of the day. So it's, you know, they're not happening at the pace that they were happening at the height of the campaign, but we, you know, there's still a strong direct action component to the campaign, even though some of the other focuses have now moved, that you know, it's been bumped up a little bit, the level of awareness about it. And I think a lot of the direct action had a lot to do with that too.
And that was an interview with Earth First co-founder Mike Rozelle, recorded at a remote campsite along the Salmon River in 2013, where Rozelle was attending the Cove Mallard Campaign 20th Anniversary Campout. We have one more recording from the 20-year anniversary campout from this camper who offered a poem of his.
In the shade or something?
Sure.
As a little introduction, when I was, I don't know how old, but my mother used to always read Longfellow to me. I think it was mostly Song of Hiawatha. I'm pretty sure she was trying to put me to sleep.
Right.
But in any event, I became acquainted with Longfellow, and one of his most famous shorter poems is called The Village Blacksmith. So I'm sitting around this morning in the camp kitchen, and I wrote this. It's called The Camp Kitchen. Under the kitchen canopy, the kitchen equipment stands, along with cartons of unfried eggs and beans and peppers and cans, empty beer bottles and a loaf of bread, an assortment of pots and pans. The kitchen crew is a valiant crew that keeps us all well fed. The first ones up, they make the coffee that revives the sleepy head, then fry the bacon over the fire, or a salmon steak instead. They make the salad that cheers us up like a salad will always do, then chop up carrots and onions, our valiant kitchen crew. They make a feast for a famished crowd, a feast that's refused by few. The salmon river below us flows, as it has always done. We've got a cooling breeze right now, before the rising sun takes on its power and heats us up, the kitchen and everyone. Later today, I'll go for a hike, but now I'm sitting right here. It's something I only get to do, maybe once or twice a year. Hike, I mean, in a place like this, with a sky so blue and clear. Under the kitchen canopy, the kitchen equipment stands, along with cartons of unfried eggs and beans and peppers and cans, empty beer bottles and a loaf of bread, an assortment of pots and pans.
That's wonderful. That's great. Well,
and that was one of the campers at the 20th anniversary campout of the Cove Mallard campaign. We'll have more remembrances of Robert Amon, also known as Ramon, who was key in the Cove Mallard campaign back in the 1990s, in just a moment as we continue on the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors, including Tie-Dye Everything, with locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located near 6th Street at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, you can find Tie-Dye Everything at tiedye-everything.com.
Ramon, who is 86 years old, died last week. His real name was Robert Amon, and we now have some remembrances of Robert Amon, or Ramon as he was called. This past Wednesday, Wild Clearwater Country Radio Show substitute host Cass Davis, who was involved in the Cove Mallard campaign, spoke to another Cove Mallard campaigner, Brett Club, who now lives in Olympia.
This is my friend Brett, and Brett, you're on the Wild Clearwater Country Show, and I've been telling people stories of Robert Amon, also known as Uncle Ramon.
Uncle Ramon.
And you kind of have a unique story on how you met Ramon. I told everybody my story of me taking money down to the Ancient Forest Bus Brigade, and I believe you were there that first trip I went down there.
Oh, to the Dixie camp?
Yeah. Before it was actually in the property, but the place where they let them stay on that old road that they blocked. Were you there that early?
No, I did not get there till 93.
Okay, that's...
And I think I would have met Ramon, I don't know, like, I think we went up there for a Memorial Day weekend event, and I guess the road must have been, I don't know, I don't remember exactly, but that's when I met Ramon, that Memorial weekend of 93, and then went up to camp, came through Moscow on the way up there, met you and a lot of the other usual suspects there, and then, went up to camp and met Ramon and the other Ancient Forest Bus Brigade people, and
That was a pretty big weekend, wasn't it? It was like a regional rendezvous.
It was. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, if I remember right, and that was. I'm trying to think. 93 was basically the year I started getting involved. I had visited him in 92, but I never really dug
my feet. Yeah, 93, the rendezvous had been at Mount Graham, and a bunch of the bus was down there, and they brought everybody up from Mount Graham, and we were all there at the camp and near Dixie, and a bunch of us got arrested in a number of different actions, including Ramon, actually.
Right.
He got arrested that year as well. And then... after that, he moved to Moscow and was living in that motel downtown.
Yeah.
And so here's this retired insurance executive who sold policies to professional baseball players and professional hockey players, and he's living in that tiny little motel, and every sort of miscreant hippie tree hugger that comes through town on the way to camp or on the way back from camp, or they're just got bored of camp and came into town, everyone's like stops by the motel room. Hey, Ramon, you know, can I have a beer? Or, hey, I need some money for food. Or, hey, and, you know, me and three people need a ride up to camp. And it was just constantly people coming through there.
Yeah.
And he, for the most part, dealt with it with a lot of grace. I you know, looking back, of course, I was one of those,
right,
you know, coming through town half supplied. I don't know what I need to bring to camp, you know, and he was very gracious, and, you know,
he would tell everybody, hey, there's this guy that lives over there. His name is Cass. You can go stay at his house.
Now get out of here.
That weekend, though, by that time in 93, though, Ramon had bought that parcel of land, because I didn't tell our listeners about that. He actually bought a chunk of land on this old, what, it was Comstock mine.
So the part of the old Comstock mine, I think he had 20 acres, and it was done, you know, like, he was known in Dixie by then, and so it's not like he could have gone to a realtor and purchased it. So some sympathetic folks who lived in Dixie, or, you know, summered in Dixie, saw that it was for sale and somehow helped him surreptitiously buy it. And then all of the folks in Dixie, you know, then all of a sudden we start showing up that summer, you know, by the hundreds. And, you know, I think it really kind of messed with their world.
Yeah. Well, I'm just to kind of fill everybody in a little bit here. Before that, there was a problem. The Ancient Forest Bus Brigade had a piece of land. Now, and the Forest Service has a law that you can't stay in any place for more than 14 days. And they had allowed the Ancient Forest Bus Brigade and these Earth Firsters to stay at the end of this road if they were to put water bars in the road and then block the entrance from the road onto this high mountain meadow that some gold panners were going out in and destroying, just digging it up with their truck, not really finding any gold, but getting stuck in this mud bogs. And of course that's going down into the salmon stream, et cetera, et cetera. But when they were there, I heard Earth Firsters telling stories of being out there peeing in the woods and then looking over and seeing like a federal agent in full camouflage. Like,
well, you know, like any time you're camped on public land, you are at the, you know, mercy of the government. If they want to surveil you, if they think that they have reason to surveil you, like yeah, they told stories, people would just, federal agents would just walk into camp and sit down at the campfire with everybody.
And there was a time when the local timber industry, now the timber that was coming out of Cove Mallard was to go to Shear Lumber Company, and Shear Lumber Company was in Elk City. Shear Lumber Company was owned by Dick Bennett, who was brothers with Frank Bennett of Bennett Lumber here locally. And I'm guessing that Frank has probably passed, and now it's just Brett Bennett. But nonetheless, those guys one time got in a helicopter. There was four of them. It was Frank, Brett Bennett, and Dick Bennett. And then the manager for the Shear Lumber Company, and his name was Dick Wilhite, and they flew in a helicopter, sat down right beside the Forest Service encampment where they were. It got out with their big pistols and left their helicopter idling, walked down the road where the Earth Firsters had put their barricade, and they had an elk skull there and a little sign that said Earth Burst. And so they unloaded their pistols on it, and then they got back in their helicopter and flew away, just as a tactic of intimidation, I would guess.
Manly Idaho man right there, eh?
Yeah. So this is one of the reasons why Ramon had to buy the land, because it was just really hard to run the campaign, and it really was integral that he bought the land. It made it to where we had kind of a safe place. All you had to do is make it up there to the land, and then you were with your brethren and your comrades. And yeah, it was a lot better. Anyway, so back at the land and stuff, how about some memories of Ramon?
Well, you know, the thing that I was remembering about Ramon was, like, he did get arrested that summer. He was part of the third big arrest. What was that like?
It was like the old goats. Because I remember that it's in the video. It's got him and Karen Pickett and what's her name? The Karen who of Asante.
Okay, yeah.
And Karen, what was her name?
It'll come to me in a minute. Anyway.
Yeah, the other Karen. And you know, and I don't remember. There was like five of them that were locked. And if you people are listening, audience, are curious, look it up on YouTube, Defending the Big Wild, and you would get to see our campaign video, and it's pretty hilarious. And as a matter of fact, that campaign video was so important because in the state of Idaho, they made it a felony for us to solicit people to do misdemeanors. So for me to ask for somebody
to... Is that law still on the books, Cass?
I haven't heard of it getting taken off the books.
No, it was never successfully used. I remember Mike Rozelle and Tom Fulleman did an action where they, you know, symbolically walked across an imaginary line and got arrested by the Forest Service and such and such. And that was supposed to be, you know, them challenging that law, but the state never charged, the feds ended up charging them with a closure violation, and the state never didn't get involved in that. And so as far as I know, that law is still on the books, but it's never been used.
Well, you know, right after they passed that law, you remember my house there on Washington Street, we put up a little billboard in the front yard with the wording of the law, you know, blowing up the...
Oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And then I took off in a car with our friend Jake from Missoula, and I drove across the whole United States clean to Washington, D.C. and back, stopping at colleges and places.
You were deeply involved in conspiring and seeking other conspiratorial allies
to
violate this felony law in Idaho.
Well, it wasn't that they violated it, because it wasn't a felony for you to involve yourself. It was a felony for you to solicit people to do that. And so with you know, like back during the Vietnam War or whatever, if you said, hey, let's go down to this place or let's go to the lunch counter and get arrested, I mean, you know, during civil rights or whatever, that was a misdemeanor to solicit people to do misdemeanors. It always has been. But this law was meant to make it a felony to solicit people to do a misdemeanor. And they never challenged it. I went down and I actually testified at the legislature against it. And I didn't do a very good job, but I did kind of tell them off a little bit. They almost had me hauled out. But I told them they make the law and I'll break the law. And I did. I went across the United States showing people the video and saying, come to Cove Mallard, get involved in direct action. you know, find your niche. Let's save some trees. And yeah, so they never intended to, you know, try to enforce that law because they knew it was unconstitutional and it would never hold muster. But it was meant to scare people from doing exactly what I did anyway, which was
right.
And yeah. I mean, have you heard the news story on Cop City this morning?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, same type of tactic.
Same deal.
Intimidation tactic.
Yeah. Throw the RICO Act at them, you know, and
so do you.
For just handing out posters, you know.
So back to Ramon and right. Cove Mallard and Moscow. So the trial of the Dirty Dozen, you remember that? That was in Moscow at some point, I don't know if it was fall of 93 or spring of...
It would have been, I think it's more 94, 95,
it was probably
like
summer
that,
of 94.
Yeah, yeah.
And Ramon and 11 other people are on trial in the federal courthouse there in Moscow for... that one action that on that one day in August 93. And it was just so funny because there was 12 different people. Some people represented themselves, some had lawyers. And they all took different defenses. Like I remember Hunter's defense was, well, I was just laying down. So how could I possibly be a threat to anybody? Because he was laying. It's like you'll see on the video that I am supine. But yeah, that trial was something else, man. That was like went on for like a whole week.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny that trial actually. One of the attorneys for that trial, who was fighting for the Earth Firsters, ended up actually being the judge in my case where I sat down in front of the megalodes going to the tar sands. So that was some strange irony. Yeah, yeah.
Well, we were educating all those lawyers back then. None of them were activist lawyers. They were all public defenders.
Right.
From across Idaho, right? That were all brought together for that. I mean, maybe one or two people hired their own lawyer. I know Ramon did, but it was all these different public defenders, and they'd never defended activists before.
Right, right.
And that was an incredible learning experience for all of them.
Remember, was it Michael Hennigan that he hired for his attorney for his representation?
No, it was Bernie Zaleha.
Bernie Zaleha, okay.
And he hired him, it's interesting, because he hired him long before he ever did the action. And he was like, look, dude, I don't know when I'll ever use you, but I want you on retainer. I'm going to give you $100 a month for the rest of my life, but you're my attorney on this stuff.
only an insurance agent would like buy
finagle that kind of deal.
Insurance, yeah.
Yeah.
Attorney insurance, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure there, hopefully, I don't know if there's anyone in your listening audience that was there, attended that trial, or any days of it. It was quite chaotic.
Yeah, I heard it was, you know, and it's kind of funny, you know, I belong to the Paradise Ridge Defense Coalition, and we're still fighting the Idaho Department of Transportation, even though they're blasting their road through under the Clean Water Act. We ended up winning a lawsuit. They paid off our attorneys anyway. But anyway, nonetheless, the attorney we now retain that's continuously making sure the Army Corps of Engineers keeps the law intact is one of the Dirty Dozen.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Defendants or one of the attorneys or one of the defendants?
One of the defendants. He was one of the arrestees way back in Cove Mallard. And I don't even remember him. I don't think I met him back then. But
was it Zach?
Yeah, yeah, Zach.
Yeah, dude, I could totally peg Zach to become a lawyer. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the cool thing about being on trial in Moscow, all right, is that law school right there. So we would go over there. A bunch of grubby tree huggers go over to the School of Law and research our cases. And, you know, especially if we were defending ourselves, which some of us did in our cases. And so that was like being in Moscow and having that right there was very helpful.
It was. You know that they moved that federal building from Moscow, and so there's no longer any federal trials here in Moscow, and there's no real place to redress grievance with government when we want to have an anti-war protest or what have you. They moved it up to not even downtown Coeur d'Alene, but just out in the sprawl of Coeur d'Alene now. It's just kind of like a non-place, and you would probably never see a demonstration in front of that federal building.
Well, that's probably by design. So you've taken over the old post office building and turned it into an anarchist housing collective.
Right. No, it's still a post office, but it's no longer, it's no longer the housing for that, for federal trials or anything like that. So it's
interesting.
Yeah. All it is the post office, and then above it, I think they just rent that all out. I don't know. Maybe it's all packed with Homeland Security. I don't know. I don't know what goes on up there.
Excuse me. You know, the thing about the Cove Mallard campaign and, you know, Ramon being a critical leadership there is that it really energized that part of Idaho's activist community. And, you know, you talk about fighting the megalodes and whatever other issues come up around there, and people cut their teeth on Cove Mallard, and some of them, you know, like there you got your guy Zach, who stuck it out, you know, became a lawyer and is still working to help. So I think that campaign was inspirational to thousands of people who went on to do more and bigger.
Well, I had only been involved in like Central American politics and, you know, bringing, you know, past CIA people to campus and stuff, people to tell us what covert wars were doing to the Third World. And that had been my only involvement in activism. And then I met the guys who got arrested for mooning federal officers, and that inspired me to go up to Cove Mallard and you know, I rounded up $5 from individuals in Moscow until I had 100 donations of $5, took $500 up there. And then Ramon wasn't there, but he looked me up and found me and offered me a breakfast and told me to put my body where my money was and get involved.
And see, that was his way. Like he was like your granddad, right? Or your uncle. And he was like, just like, oh, let's share some breakfast, and you know, we'll talk about this, and then he just talked you into going and sticking your neck out.
I'm sure that we can blame Uncle Ramon for the brainwash of Cass Davis.
Well, now that he's gone, we can blame him for a whole lot, you know.
Yeah. If I was going to get arrested tomorrow, I would say Ramon made me do it.
Ramon made me do it.
And that was Wild Clearwater Country Radio Show substitute host Cass Davis speaking with a fellow Cove Mallard campaigner from the Earth First campaign to save the Cove Mallard area in central Idaho, southeast of Grangeville, Brett Club, who now lives in Olympia. That was recorded here on KRFP this past Wednesday afternoon. And they were remembering Robert Amon, also known as Ramon, who died at the age of 86, reportedly this past Saturday. Ramon was instrumental in the Cove Mallard campaign. He was 86 years old. So finally, we have a letter Ramon wrote to Chuck Pajeski of Pullman, apparently 2 days before he died. Chuck Pajeski is on Ramon's birthday letter list, and the letter was dated August 30th. Ramon reportedly died last Saturday, and this letter, as reproduced on Chuck Pajeski's Facebook page this week, was obviously typed with a manual typewriter. It says, 30 August 23, "Hey Chuck, birthday greetings, possibly for the last time from me. I seem to have developed that 86-year-old going on 90 known as the conveyor belt to you-know-where. Nonetheless, I soldier on with these stupid letters until my fingers can no longer depress the keys. But I digress as always. This is supposed to be your official annual friggin' happy friggin' birthday letter, is it not? Ergo, Happy friggin' birthday. So there. On a happier note, my new medico has prescribed 32 sessions of some sort of rehab. My usually reliable lungs and legs don't seem to want to work anymore. After which, she says, it will be my decision whether quantity of life trumps quality of life when she'll change my treatment. I'm not exactly sure what this means in Maryland, where assisted suicide is not yet legal, but it did sound encouraging. I mean, what the hell, Chuck? I've had an incredible life, and what's the point of slowly deteriorating? In the famous words of Bill Packer, take me out, coach, I've had enough. He now has Alzheimer's. And that's enough of that for the, can't read that word. Have a great day on the 11th, old buddy. Tilt back one or three for me. All the best, Ramon. And that was written, apparently, on August 30th. Ramon, dead at the age of 86. You are tuned into the KRFP Evening Report. And we'll be back with another featured segment on the Evening Report in just a moment.
Love's Kombucha is proud to support KRFP Radio Free Moscow. Love's Kombucha is a fun, lively, fermented probiotic tea that is craft brewed right here in Moscow. For more information, visit loveskombucha.com.
こちらは KRFP Moscow, Idaho, 米国。
We now turn to our second featured segment concerning the active shooter incident just west of downtown in Moscow early Tuesday morning. Moscow police say Officer Jay Waters contacted shooting suspect Thomas Adams about 2.5 hours before he allegedly shot his guns 50 or 60 times from his apartment in the 100 block of South Almond Street starting at about 2 a.m. Tuesday. That seems to correspond with the account neighbor Sierra Valentine gave to KRFP Tuesday afternoon in an interview. Valentine said Adams was shooting at her when she took her dog for a walk at 2 a.m. and many bullets went into her house where she was. According to the Daily News, Officer Jay Waters wrote in a report, Adams told him he had won the lottery while he was in the Persian Gulf, and people on motorcycles were trying to steal his money. The report said Adams went to a neighbor's house to call police and said he was afraid to go back to his apartment. Adams allegedly said later in the conversation that he did not see the people on motorcycles and could not confirm there was a gunshot directed at him. Waters said he escorted Adams back to his apartment and saw at least three AR-15-style firearms on the floor of the apartment. The police report says Waters later heard 50 or 60 gunshots of various calibers coming from Adams' apartment building between 2 and 4 a.m., and because the sliding glass door to the balcony of Adams' apartment appeared to be damaged by gunfire, and because of statements in calls from other residents who reported gunfire in the apartment building, Waters concluded Adams was doing the shooting. We'll now rerun the KRFP interview with Sierra Valentine, who lives on Jackson Street and operates a barbershop there. It was recorded Tuesday afternoon. Okay, we are with Sierra Valentine. Tell me what happened to you early this morning.
Well, it started a lot longer than earlier this morning ago. About a year or so ago, this guy lost his job because he had too much diarrhea and he was a travel nurse. And that's the most that I've ever learned about him until recently. He got fired from Gritman because he had too much diarrhea. And he kept telling me that. And he made me feel very uncomfortable, not because of that, but because he was literally trying to come over and talk to me when I was clearly not wanting to talk to him. And then he tried to give me booze. And I said, no, I don't want that. Take it away. And he got really offended because I didn't want to take his alcohol that he probably got poisoned. And so he got his ego hurt a bit. He tried to talk to me a few other times, and I was very dismissive of him. And he became obsessed with me. And he, last night at 10 p.m., he came over. He tried to get into my yard, and my dog started barking at him. And that's how I noticed that he was there. There were no gunshots at that point. And he came over to my back gate. He tried to gain access to my yard, and he said, shots fired, call 911. I called 911. I didn't know what to say to them, so I put it on speakerphone. I handed him the phone. I went inside, got my guns, came back outside, locked my gate with a padlock, and I didn't think much about it because he's a nutbag. And a couple hours later, 2 a.m. rolls around. I still haven't heard anything else. He was also saying that, 3 men on motorcycles were chasing him with guns. Also, didn't hear any of that, didn't see any of that. He's a lunatic. That was 10 o'clock, 2 a.m. I decide to take my dogs on a walk before bed, and I go out my front gate, and I cross the street, and I hear 3 gunshots at me, and I see the blinking, the flash, and my dogs and I bolt inside, and then there's just like shot after shot after shot after shot after shot. It was shot, 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 and then they'd wait, and then it was shot, 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 and then they'd go and wait. And then he just kept shooting. And I have a shit ton of holes in my house, and he shot through my grandparents' heirloom $9,000 dresser, and he tried to murder me because his penis felt so tiny, because I didn't want it. I don't know.
How long have you been having encounters with this, neighbor one block away?
Not even a block away. No, he looks directly into my backyard. He has been looking directly into my backyard from his balcony for the last, I don't know, I noticed about a year ago. And I was having other problems with other creepy old men neighbors. And I was paying attention to them more, and I didn't think that he would try and murder me. I know, that's...
Where are the bullet holes in your various buildings?
Well, let's see. Sterling's old bedroom got shot up, so that's the barbershop side bedroom. That's the main damage to the house part. He shot through my carport. He shot into my karaoke shed. He ruined all of my speakers except for my Bluetooth speaker, thank God. Now I can blast on that. He also wrecked my karaoke TV, and I had just learned how to play a video game, and I'm really pissed off because I would like to play it because I have a broken arm, and I just want maybe not to get murdered.
Yeah, and you were in the house when shots were fired into the house?
For some of them, I evacuated about 3:30 or something, which was also crazy, because they were like, hey, we need you to evacuate. And I'm like, while shots are going on? And they were like, yeah, just go outside with your hands up. And I'm like, please don't shoot me. I have a wrist brace on because I have a broken arm. And then they're like, oh, yeah, we won't shoot you. We'll make sure they know. And so my roommate and I go out the front, and we're with our hands up. We're, like, trying to find whoever was supposed to meet us. They just said, go east, and we'll have an officer meet you. And not finding the officer who was supposed to meet us, which is fine. I get it. They're busy. It's a standoff. No problem. However, then I just, you know, headed east, went to my mom's house with my roommate, and we have not slept. And it sucks.
Yeah.
I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, you did.
No. There was this dumbass. He decided to come out for a cigarette while my roommate and I were literally running towards the police with our hands up. And he was like, oh, what's going on? I'm like, go inside. And I kept yelling, go inside. And he just didn't. He decided to light his cigarette and come with us. And then he also had to get frisked. He was an idiot.
And have you been talking to the police about the previous encounters with this person?
Yes. I informed them about that probably about 10 a.m. But, like, that's not entirely true. I've told them a couple of times, but, yeah.
Before last night, yeah.
What?
Before last night, you were talking about him to the police.
Before last night, I talked to just about everybody about him, but I don't remember if I called the police on him, because I also had to call the police on two other creepy old men that were either taking pictures of me in my backyard, in my bikini, or, you know, up from number 7 next door. Or, let's see, the other guy, he was weird too. He was also going up and down the street, looking into my yard. I don't know why I'm so interesting. I don't think I'm that interesting. I'm cool, right? But, like, creepy old men need to talk.
All right. Anything else you have to say about this situation? I suppose you're hoping that this person stays in jail or is...
Or, like, fries. I know he's not going to fry. Like, he didn't actually murder anybody, so he'll probably be out next week. But, you know, he could, you know, hang himself or something. That'd be fine. I don't give a shit. Just don't go back to that apartment or go anywhere near me. I am armed, by the way, just in case he's listening.
That was Jackson Street resident Sierra Valentine, who says shooter suspect Thomas Adams was shooting at her and her home from his South Almond Street apartment building balcony overlooking her backyard. Residents in the area of the 100 block of South Almond Street reported hearing multiple gunshots at about 2:05 a.m. on Tuesday. Police responded and closed off area streets to vehicular traffic, including U.S. Highway 95 south as it runs through the city on Jackson Street. Police also closed numerous streets to traffic downtown and just west of downtown. They said people who live in the area of the 100 block of South Almond Street should shelter in place. As of 5:45 a.m. on Tuesday, police from numerous jurisdictions were gathered at West 3rd and Jackson Streets with men in camo with long guns. They waved away any pedestrian who got within a half a block. There were police vehicles from the Moscow Police Department, the Nez Perce County Sheriff's Department, Idaho State Police, and Pullman Police Department gathered at 3rd and Jackson. Other police cars were blocking streets, including U.S. Highway 95 south at D Street and North Main Streets. City crews placed traffic barricades at various locations, including East 3rd and Washington Streets. Crews blocked the Pullman Highway at Line Street. The Moscow School District announced Lena Whitmore Elementary School would not hold classes Tuesday due to the ongoing standoff, and they closed streets near the school. Superintendent Sean Teagues announced all other schools in the district would operate as normal Tuesday. The Moscow Police Department said SWAT team officers arrested 54-year-old Thomas Adams in the apartment on South Almond Street at about 8:05 a.m. Tuesday. Shortly after that, police lifted the shelter-in-place advisory. Adams is charged with discharging a firearm in city limits, disturbing the peace, and resisting and obstructing officers. Moscow police officer Jay Waters wrote, "In between bursts of shooting, Adams walked onto his balcony and sat down and drank a beer and then went back inside."
And Moscow Police Captain Anthony Dollinger said Tuesday there may be additional charges against Adams. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report, special extended Friday edition. We'll be back in a moment.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and by Moscow Ale House, with something for everyone in the family. You can find Moscow Ale House at 226 West 6th Street or call 208-882-BREW. That's 208-882-2739.
As a doctor, I've seen too many women with breast cancer who could have avoided extensive treatment or even death had they just gotten an annual mammogram. Every major medical organization experienced in breast cancer recommends annual mammograms for women 40 and older. Please, if you are 40 or older, get a mammogram every year. If you have a family history or other risk factors, talk to your doctor about what's right for you. To find an accredited center, visit mammographysaveslives.org.
And you're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report, special extended Friday edition. We now turn to our final segment. On Tuesday, Moscow Saturday Farmers Market Commission Chair Jamie Hill said the market is overflowing with vendors this year and the market has to turn some potential vendors away every week. Hill spoke during Tuesday night's Moscow City Council meeting. Here is a 4-minute segment from that report.
So here's the fun stuff. All of the numbers. Last year, 2022, we had 133 eligible vendors. This year, we are up to 149. One of the amazing, amazing problems, I get to say amazing, Amanda gets to say challenging, problems that we have discovered this year is that we have hit capacity for the majority of the markets. So the weekly email that normally goes out and says, hi, vendors, we can't wait to see you Saturday, here's your space assignment, says now, hi, vendors, can't wait to probably see you Saturday, here's your space assignment, or where you are on the wait list. We are overflowing with vendors, and it is such an exciting challenge to see, but I know that it's also probably quite the heck. So that's pretty exciting. I will say within those 149 vendors, this year we onboarded 38 new vendors total. That includes 10 that were ag, 19 that were craft, and 10 that were food. So lots and lots of new faces at market. I usually try and introduce myself to new vendors, and it's been really weird this summer because every week I feel like there's a new face that I get to go and meet and go, Have I met you yet? Have I not found all of them yet? It's kind of exciting. Other kind of some information. We have our craft and food jury every year. These are the crafts that you see. These are the specialty prepared foods that you see. Everyone from Patty's Kitchen, Larissa's Apron, Sister's Cookies, to KS Ceramics, and any of like the other crafts, jewelry that you see. They actually go through a jury process to get into the market. We look at them, we kind of evaluate their product and their process to see if they meet our mission and they would be good candidates for the market. This year we had 110 inquiries of joining the market for only 45 spots within that jury process. And we ended up doing 42 vendors that were registered and juried out of those 45 spots. But obviously, we're still hitting capacity. So that's a great thing. And what is also really interesting is that for next year, where did I put this number? We already have 72 inquiries about jurying into the market for next year. This market hasn't ended, and we have 72 asks about how to get into it next year for non-ag vendors. So that is mind-blowing. And then the third thing on there is our customer counts. We've been doing rapid market assessments and customer counts for the last few years, really trying to calculate not only how many people we're seeing in the market, adults and children, but also some of our RMAs have led to larger questions like, what is the economic impact of the market on the city of Moscow and the county? Last year, our customer counts put us at an average of about 7,421 adults per week. That doesn't include the kids. I want to say that number was in the 3,000s. That was just by counting and doing data processes that are cool. And this year, our customer count is looking to be on trend with that, possibly a little bit higher. I will say we've been counting once a month, and the first few months looked about like that. The last month looked better than that, and I have a feeling heading into September with our date that those numbers will continue to increase. As reference, I know we kind of hate doing this, but pre that thing that happened in 2020, we were averaging 10,000 adults per week. So it's really encouraging to see kind of the growth of the community coming back and hitting hopefully an 8,000-ish number this year.
And that was Moscow Farmers Market Commission Chair Jamie Hill giving the Moscow City Council an update on the Saturday Farmers Market, which is held downtown Moscow on Main Street every Saturday from May until the end of October. Farmers Market hours are 8 a.m. until 1 p.m. on Saturdays. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow Pullman area, mostly clear through Sunday night with a low of 50 tonight, high 82 tomorrow, low 51 Saturday night, high 85 Sunday, and a low of 52 Sunday night, and partly sunny on Monday, high 82. Currently 70 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. There you can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can also adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. And also on the website, you can stream KRFP and listen to the archives of any show broadcast on KRFP in the last 2 weeks. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Jim Roach and Kurt Morrison assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
Programming on KRFP is made possible in part by support from KRFP members and
John's Alley Tavern, Moscow's home of live music. John's Alley is located at 114 East 6th Street in downtown Moscow.